Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Many Americans are carrying an enormous amount of student loan debt. About 1.4 million borrowers in North Carolina alone have about $54.5 billion in outstanding principal and interest owed on federal student loans as of June 30th. The Biden administration implemented multiple student loan forgiveness programs and in 2023 launched the Saving on a Valuable Education, or SAVE, plan, capping payments at 5% of discretionary income for undergraduate borrowers and forgiving loans after 10 years for certain other borrowers. Since Donald Trump took office, that plan has been in limbo, with interest accrual and required payments delayed. But now things are moving in a different direction. Beginning this month, SAVE borrowers are watching as interest ticks in or kicks in. But they have the opportunity to change their plan for a limited time until provisions of the Big Beautiful Bill end the plan entirely. There's a lot at stake, and it's very Byzantinian, if that's a word, and the changing landscape of student debt is in flux. So this hour, we attempt to paint a clearer picture of where things stand and what options borrowers today and future borrowers tomorrow may have. We're joined by Betsy Mayotte, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. Mike Pierce is executive director and co-founder of the Student Borrower Protection Center. And Corey Turner follows all this as an education reporter or correspondent at NPR. Good morning to you all. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Corey, President Biden's student loan forgiveness program was controversial in some circles because people didn't like the idea of just forgiving debt. But the way it was originally envisioned, that particularly raised some hackles on the right, but it was struck down by the Supreme Court. The administration then pivoted and it began a series of targeted forgiveness efforts, and they did pass legal muster. But much of that is now being rolled back by the Trump administration. And on top of that, the Trump administration is working on an overhaul of the entire federal student loan system. You have called this a grade A mess for borrowers trying to figure out how to navigate through it all. So how many people are we talking about who are right now, today, this minute, affected by this?
Oh, Mike, I don't know. I'd say probably all of the borrowers in the system are going to be affected in some way, shape, or form, which we know is around 43 million people, even now after various forgiveness programs in the Biden administration. I think the challenge right now, Mike, is that it's not one thing. It is so many things. And I think maybe, since you started with me, I'll just try to set the table for a second, which is, so we know the SAVE plan is on hold, and it wasn't put on hold by President Trump. It was put on hold by the courts, who so far seem inclined to believe, as Republicans argue, that SAVE is just too generous to be legal. And we got to keep in mind, there are, I think, by last count I heard from the Education Department, there are about 7.7 million borrowers in the SAVE plan. Right. And the challenge for them, as you said in the intro, is interest started accruing. Now they need to figure out where to go. Right. They want to start making payments. They don't want the interest to explode their debts. They need to figure that out. But it's not just this SAVE limbo. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act that Republicans in Congress passed mounts essentially a complete reset or overhaul of the federal student loan program, trying to condense the, by my count, roughly seven repayment plans down to two, which again is going to be confusing, especially for future borrowers or really honestly for current borrowers, because current borrowers really have no understanding right now what plans are still open to them, what plans aren't, what plans will be sunsetted by the administration, so on and so forth. I'll leave it for there. I could talk the rest of the hour about what is and isn't, but want to make sure Mike and Betsy get a shot here.
And I'm sorry that you're able to do that, because that means you understand all this, which is really mind-blowing to me. I mentioned, Betsy, that about 1.4 million borrowers in North Carolina owe about $54.5 billion in student loans. And I think nationally that figure is truly gargantuan. According to the U.S. Department of Education, the total federal student loan debt stands at $1.67 trillion, involving about 43 million people. Can you put that number into perspective? How does that number, the $1.67 trillion in debt, compare to what people owe in mortgages or car payments or payments for their furniture, etc.? Where does that stand?
Yeah, so as of this exact moment, I don't know exactly where it stands, but I know for in fairly recent memory, student loan debt outpaced what people owed in credit cards and other types of consumer debt. The average student loan debt per federal student loan borrower is right around $37,000 on the national level. But that includes people who have undergraduate degrees and associate's degrees. The people we see that owe the six figures in debt are those who have chosen to pursue education beyond that, graduate and professional degrees.
And Mike, your organization, the Student Borrower Protection Center, is leading a nationwide effort to end what you call the student debt crisis. Is it a student debt crisis for the students who have borrowed the money, or is it a debt crisis for the country because it's at a gargantuan amount of money?
We've done research looking at the ways that student debt affects people's behavior, and it also affects local economies, and it affects the rest of us. When people can't start families, they can't buy houses, they can't buy cars, they can't live the American dream because they're being dragged down by the weight of this unaffordable debt and also a student loan system that's never been able to deliver on its promises.
And the fact that we have all these changes to the student loan system that have come in the last several years, is that contributing to the crisis, or is that a crisis unto itself? Betsy, you're nodding.
Listen, I've been working in the student loan industry since the earth cooled, and I've researched higher ed policy back to the 70s, and I can say without worrying that I'm going to be being overly dramatic about it, this is the most chaotic time that has ever occurred in student loan policy, and that is absolutely contributing to the crisis. Borrowers are confused, and the goalposts keep changing, the rules keep changing, and that's contributing to the crisis, absolutely.
Could this have been avoided, Mike? Is this just simply a changeover in administrations and a changeover in political philosophy and the way they look at student loans, or is there more to it than that that's creating this confusion?
Confusion is one way to describe it, but really these are policy choices. This administration has made the decision to add costs to people's balance sheets, to make promises and not deliver on them. And at the end of the day, this is a choice to make people pay more money on their student loans. And Congress rewrote the rules for borrowers, and we're going to get into that. But you don't have to worry about what's legal and what's not when you're talking about congressional action here. They had the chance to make life cheaper for people, and they chose to make it more expensive. It's as simple as that.
So, Corey, let's back up a bit. And because yesterday when I was preparing for this conversation, I knew nothing about this. And as I was reading through the material, it was mind-blowing to me. I really couldn't. I had great difficulty wrapping my head around it. So there are a lot of people listening to us who have no exposure to this at all and may not even know what we're talking about. So let's back up and talk about the nearly 7.7 million borrowers who enrolled in the Biden-era SAVE program. What was that program supposed to do?
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing for me about the SAVE plan, going back to one of the first stories I ever did on it, was that President Biden announced the SAVE plan at the same press conference where he announced his sweeping federal student loan forgiveness proposal. And I've always thought of the SAVE plan as a kind of plan B, I guess, because it really is incredibly generous. It just is by any measure compared to any previous repayment plan. It would have, again, as you said in the intro, it would have pegged payments, at least for undergraduate borrowers, at 5% of their income, which is half as much as it was previously. And it also instituted a sort of fast-track loan forgiveness for borrowers with smaller debts. Those are the 10-year forgiveness borrowers. And the challenge is that, Republican state attorneys general sued during the Biden administration, took it to the courts, and the courts were fairly unsympathetic. The plan has been enjoined, although nothing has been decided yet. It is still in legal limbo. That's the strange thing about all of this. The limbo just keeps going. And I think what borrowers need to know, though, is like there has always been the either-or of the SAVE plan. Are the courts going to kill it first, or will the incoming Trump administration and Congress kill it first? And what we see in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act is a plan to sunset SAVE by July of 2028, regardless of what the courts decide. And so I think now, especially with interest beginning to accrue for SAVE borrowers, the urgency begins for these borrowers to understand that they need to make a choice. The challenge is I haven't heard a lot from the department explaining to these SAVE borrowers what those choices are and what makes the most sense to them.
Yeah, the I guess it's been in limbo so long because the courts move very slowly on many things, as we have found over the last several years. The court ruling that the Department of Education lacked the authority to offer 0% interest under the SAVE plan's framework is what's under consideration, among other things. I know you want to get into this, Mike, but well, go ahead, take it now, and I'll ask Corey my next question.
I just wanted to flag as we're talking about what courts have decided are legal or not legal and how slow courts move. The Trump administration asked to go slow here. They walked into court shoulder to shoulder with these Republican AGs and said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, Judge, we don't need a decision. We're going to figure this out and we'll get back to you with a plan." 90 days roll by, nothing happens. They come back into court and say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, Judge, don't worry about this. We got this under control." Another 90 days go by. So borrowers are sitting in limbo here, not because the judicial system is slow, but because nobody seems particularly bothered by the status quo, and that's really concerning for people that are struggling.
So,
Well, let
Corey.
me add to that, Mike, just to complete the context here. The administration argued, "Let us fix this." What court would not rather Congress handle things? If you want to change it legally. You're Congress, and this new act essentially does that. It offers Republicans alternative to the SAVE plan. What is lacking right now is a clear step-by-step explainer to borrowers in the program what they should be doing. The department fast-tracked interest accrual, but they're not actually, as far as I can tell and from what I've heard, they're not expediting the explanation to borrowers. Here's what you should be doing.
That was my next question, because the interest kicked in, began accruing again on August the 1st. So people in this SAVE plan have either they have a decision to make about whether or not to pay the interest on their loans, or whether to choose one of these other two plans. But as you have described, Corey, these other two plans are pretty ill-defined, if defined at all, and have
And they
not yet
don't
been
exist yet.
solidified. Okay, so they don't exist. So
No.
why sunset the interest I'm not. I can't find the word. Why sunset interest accrual if you haven't got an alternative? Why do that?
I don't have an answer to that question. That is a question for the Education Department and the Trump administration.
Okay, so we have these two programs that are in the offing, but they will not be ready. They're not ready yet, and they are scheduled to begin in what, 2027?
Next year.
Next year, 26. So we'll talk about those when we come back. We're talking about student loans and where the programs to save interest or save the people from the incredible debt that they are accruing stands at the moment, because it is all in transition. Corey Turner's with us, education correspondent for NPR, Mike Pierce with the Student Borrower Protection Center, and Betsy Mayotte with the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about student loans and the student loan program, where the forgiveness of all of that lies at the moment, because things are in flux. Corey Turner's with us from NPR. Betsy Mayotte is the president and founder of the Institute for Student Loan Advisors, or of Student Loan Advisors. And Mike Pierce is executive director and co-founder of Student Borrower Protection Center. And you sent me a little note here, Mike, during the break to say that by your own back of the envelope calculations, the restarting of interest, which began on August the 1st, will affect 269,000 people in North Carolina alone, who collectively owe more than $15 billion in student debt, and they'll be charged nearly $1 billion in interest over the next 12 months. So there are these two programs that the Trump administration has been banting about, but they're not ready and they won't go into effect for a while. So, and we'll talk about what those two programs may or may not offer, but what if you were in the position of being a member of the SAVE program and suddenly you have to start paying interest, but you don't have to? What's your best advice? What would you do at this point?
That's actually the number one question we're getting here at TISLA lately. So our organization, what we do, the reason we were created is to provide free student loan advice to all borrowers. And by far the number one question is from SAVE borrowers saying, what do I do now? And the answer is not simple. There are, you know, 25 variables that will dictate what might be the best choice for them moving forward. Are they pursuing loan forgiveness under income-driven plans? What is their income? What do they owe? Will they be able to afford whatever the next lowest payment is? I could go on for the rest of the program with these variables, but that is the number one question we're getting.
But the bill will come due no matter what your decision is, it seems to me. So if suddenly interest is being accruing, but you don't have to pay the interest, or you could pay the interest and not pay the principal while you're waiting on the final decision of what plans they're going to offer you, wouldn't it be wiser not to accrue more debt by not paying the interest?
It depends. For borrowers that are pursuing, say, public service loan forgiveness, they should not be paying the interest. You shouldn't be paying a penny more than what you're required to, because once you fulfill the requirements for that program, the rest of the balance is forgiven. But most borrowers are not going to have their loans forgiven. So those people, it may make more sense to be paying that interest, or at least not letting it build up, or to switch plans right now.
But even for PSLF borrowers, right, Betsy, the time they're spending in this SAVE forbearance won't count towards their required time served.
Not right away, but there is a provision in the regulations called buyback that will allow them. And, you know, it's been slow in coming, but they are processing buybacks.
We warned you, Mike. There is not a single clear answer to any of these questions.
Yeah, so they can, and you know, I have borrowers in the TISLA paddock that have had their buybacks approved, but they can use what's called buyback for the SAVE forbearance. But the problem with buyback is you're paying everything at once, and it's taking forever. Like, so by forever, I mean 6 or 8 months.
So now we're in
because
the
education department now officially has half the staff that it had 3 months ago.
And they weren't processing them for a long time.
We're into jargon and acronyms now, so we're in real deep trouble.
Don't get us started, Mike.
So I have a question about, since it is so complicated and there are so many important decisions to be made here in the short term and eventually in the long term, Mike, do people know, does an average student loan debtor know about your organization, about Betsy's organization? Do they know where to get answers to some of their questions? Do they know you exist?
So we don't provide direct services to people. That's really Betsy's territory. I will say we do take companies to court for making things harder for people. And the entire federal apparatus is telling you to call your student loan servicer and ask for help and enroll in a payment plan you can afford. You have the Secretary of Education on social media, in the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, saying it's time to pay your bills. And what we actually see is people can't. More than 1.3 million applications for other affordable payment plans are sitting on unprocessed at the Department of Education in a giant backlog while people are trying to figure out how to make heads or tails of this mess.
So they have these two plans, Corey, that are in the offing but haven't been solidified, won't be available for a while now, the standard plan and the repayment assistance plan. How do they differ? And are they for borrowers who have already incurred this debt or for future borrowers who may be considering taking out a student loan?
Sure. And before I even answer that question, I should say I wrote a story a couple weeks ago that goes super nerdy into the weeds on all of this stuff. And it's funny, I can look at the analytics of our stories, and this story just keeps going and going. It has a life of its own because borrowers are finding it. So I would encourage anyone who wants at least a somewhat detailed roadmap. The story is called What Borrowers Should Know About Student Loan Changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill. And it includes much of what I am going to say now in answer to your question. So there are two plans in that act that has been passed. And these are the two plans that are intended to replace everything else for future borrowers. So borrowers who take out loans, I believe it's after July 2026. I'll try to be short here. The first plan is pretty straightforward. It is a gentle reimagining of the standard plan, the good old-fashioned, your monthly payment is fixed like a mortgage payment, and your repayment window is spread out over a certain amount of time between 10 and 25 years, depending on the size of your loan. Now, if you can't afford that, if that sounds really difficult for you based on your finances, the act also creates its own new version of an income-based plan. It's called, as you said, the Repayment Assistance Plan, or the RAP, that's what I call it. And this thing's interesting, and I want to give credit where credit's due. There are a few things about this plan that I think will surprise a lot of folks who are expecting maybe something more cynical from Republicans. Number one, just like the SAVE plan, the RAP plan waives interest that accrues on a loan beyond what a borrower can afford to repay in a given month. So interest will not blow up your loan. It also offers a really interesting principal match payment for truly low-income borrowers. Everyone's going to be required to pay at least 10 bucks a month. Gone are the days of the $0 monthly payment. But for those low-income borrowers who can really only afford that 10 bucks, this plan will give them up to $50 in like a rebate towards their principal, so that they will even see the principal of their loan go down every month. Now, obviously, and I'm sure Mike is going to jump in here, the forgiveness window is 30 years. And I've talked to conservative and liberal economists both who say, look, very few borrowers are still going to have loan debts left after 30 years. This is not really a forgiveness plan. But as I said, there's some interesting things here, but these are just for future borrowers. The options are very different, and there are more options for legacy borrowers.
So, Betsy, I know that there are lots of variables. It depends on the person coming to you for advice and what their situation is and what their degree will be in and how many years they're going to have to incur debt to achieve the goal of their career plan. But there are these two plans, the standard plan and the repayment plan. And as Corey just said, the standard plan offers you a fixed payment, like a fixed interest mortgage rate. You know what your payment's going to be, and you know the term of the loan. The other plan, the repayment assistance or the RAP plan, is based on your income and would require a minimum monthly payment, as Corey said. So as a student loan advisor, what are your thoughts on these two plans? How do you tell the people you're working with which is the better plan for them?
Well, you know, as you pointed out, you could have two borrowers that owe the exact same amount of money and have the exact same income, and still the answer is going to be different because of, you know, their other financial responsibilities or priorities and so on. So the best thing you can do in that situation is give them a ballpark figure of what each of those payments will be, but more importantly, what those plans will cost them over time. So it's not just about what's affordable today. It's also about let's think about the future and how much you're going to pay out of pocket. So what we try to do is give them an estimate of both of those things, and hopefully they can use that data to make the decision that's best for them.
So I read that article, Corey, that you wrote about this, and you report that the minimum monthly payment for the wrap plan is $10 a month. But you also quote Roxanne Garza, who is the director of higher education policy at EdTrust, which is a liberal-leaning organization. She says that that payment might cause more low-income people to default. Really? $10 a month is going to make or break the bank here?
I mean, that is the perspective of some advocates who speak on behalf of our lowest income borrowers. Research suggests that the point of the $10 payment is to help or to encourage borrowers to feel a bit of skin in the game without plunging them into default. You know, I think there are arguments both ways. I will say one thing we see in the data, and I blame the pandemic for this and the very long repayment pause. I think it's very clear that a whole lot of borrowers have fallen out of touch with their loans, and that's a problem. And I think that's a problem that the Trump administration feels acutely. And you can argue whether or not they're approaching it cynically or not, whether they have borrowers' best interests in mind. I think it's a problem. And I'm not quite sure how you fix it. I was just looking over brand new data from the New York Fed, and they found that 10%, right, 10% of all student loan debt in the second quarter of 2025 was more than 90 days delinquent. That's a problem.
If I could just offer maybe the other argument here on why $10 a month is a problem here. It's not just a problem for borrowers. It's a problem for the student loan system. We are making people document that they have no income. These are the borrowers that have no income. They have raised their hands. They have told the government they have no income. And making the decision, this is a public program, we're making the decision that these people with no income, who have proven they have no income, have to make a payment every month. That's bad public policy. And instead of making the student loan system work to help people that do have income make payments they can afford, we're going to turn these student loan companies into debt collectors. And they're just going to chase down these people that have already said they have no income. They're going to destroy their credit. They're going to make their lives miserable. And to what end?
So the Biden program has been described as overly generous, and that was one of the major objections to it, to simply forgiving debt outright that you knew that you were going to incur when you took out the loans. It seemed a bad policy to a lot of people. This new approach is different, although Corey has pointed out that it does have some advantages, at least some of them do, like the interest portion of your loan is forgiven as you pay it down, or it's not outright forgiveness, but it does help along the way. What has been the reaction, Michael, to these various proposals?
People are going to pay more money on their student loans. And the reality of that bill, come and due, being bigger, is just starting to sink in for the borrowers that we talk to. It's not clear to me that lots of people are going to be able to afford these payments. And we're already starting to see a wave of borrowers fall behind. 6 million people over the past 6 months have become more than 90 days past due on their student loans. This has spillover effects across their lives. They're no longer able to qualify for a conventional mortgage. The cost of a car loan has doubled. There's a whole body of research that talks about how this causes long-term damage to people's finances.
And there is another program that I don't think we've talked about it yet, all these acronyms floating in the breeze here, but it's the income-based repayment program. That is still available, as I understand it, Corey, to borrowers who take out loans by July 1st of 2026, so that's next year. You've called it a loan forgiveness program, sort of. Explain how.
Yeah, well, so IBR, I know, forgive me. The fascinating thing about that plan, and it is just called income-based repayment, is it is the one income-based plan that was created explicitly by Congress. And that's why it remains this sort of island of legal safety. It's a little respite for borrowers for now. Now, the administration has frozen forgiveness under IBR, claiming all of the legal confusion around SAVE has kind of tainted everything for the time being. But I'm sure Betsy will tell you, for many SAVE borrowers who have already accrued time towards loan forgiveness, IBR might make good sense for them. And unlike some of these other plans, like, it is open to them now. And under the old rules of IBR, folks with loans taken out before 2014 qualify for forgiveness after 25 years. Folks with loans taken out after 2014 still qualify for forgiveness after 20 years. So that's one option.
But as I understand it, from reading your writing on this, Corey, that the Department of Education has temporarily stopped processing loan forgiveness for borrowers because of the legal actions and the questions surrounding the SAVE program. So what are the implications of that, Mike? I mean, it seems to me that puts everybody, nobody knows what to do.
Certainly that includes the Secretary of Education. We are suing the Trump administration on behalf of American Federation of Teachers right now in federal court to try to get them to start processing loan forgiveness again because the law requires it. The story the government is telling about these court cases is just wrong as a legal matter. The courts have not weighed in on whether income-based repayment can cancel people's loans. They're just choosing not to allow people to invoke their rights, and that's wrong, and that's illegal.
So, Betsy, clearly the rules have changed from the Biden to the Trump administration. They are continuing to change. They will probably continue to change in the future. But the people who have longstanding student loan debt, who may have gotten onto the SAVE program, knew when they took that debt out what they were going to owe. And presumably they knew the terms of the loan and how interest would accrue and what they'd be paying off eventually. So should we feel sorry for them? I mean, yes, things are changing now. Yes, they may have to start paying interest again. No, they may not get loan forgiveness that they hoped they would get, but they knew that going in.
Here's the thing, Mike. You know, when they instituted the SAVE plan, you know, eight million plus borrowers got on it. They were saying, they were told, this is what your payment amount is. And historically, repayment plans have never been challenged before. This had never happened before. And historically, Congress has never removed a benefit from existing borrowers, which has also happened as a result of the budget bill. So borrowers had no reason to think that it could change down the line. And so they made other financial decisions. The other thing I'm seeing in the TISLA inbox is, my SAVE payment was X. I made other financial decisions based on that, and now it's going to triple. And what do I do?
And therein lies the rub. We're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about student loans, where they stand, where the student loan forgiveness plans stand, all the things that are kicking in because of the one big beautiful bill that passed, and also changes in the SAVE plan that was put in by the Biden administration, taken out by the Trump administration, and on and on and on. Corey Turner is with us. He's education correspondent for NPR. Mike Pierce is executive director and co-founder of the Student Borrower Protection Center. And Betsy Mayotte is with us. She's the president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. You were talking just before the break, Betsy, about how, because of the SAVE program and that suspended payments for a lot of people for a relatively long time, they made other financial decisions. Perhaps they bought a car. Perhaps they got a better apartment with a higher rent payment every month. And now suddenly, they now have to start paying back their student loans again, and they can't afford it because they made, as you said, other financial decisions. These are people with college degrees. There's no guarantee what the future may bring for anybody. Should we feel sorry for them?
Well, it's not so much about the fact that their payments were paused and they went, oh, I don't have a student loan payment, so I'm going to go buy a new car. It's more about, here's the payment amount I was told I was going to have. And it was going to be $250 a month on the SAVE plan. So I budgeted for, say, a mortgage, budgeting that my student loan payment would be $250 a month. And again, repayment plans have never, ever been challenged before. So they had no reason to think that was going to change. Well, now that SAVE is gone and there's no other plan that's even remotely as generous as the SAVE plan was, they find out that their payment's going to be $750 a month. But they already took that mortgage and they budgeted on a $250 a month payment. So do I feel sorry for people in that situation? I do, because the goalpost and the rules changed and they had no reason to think they were going to.
If so I can frame it a little bit differently, I would say I don't think borrowers need our pity. I think they want justice. The government told them these were the rules. They did what the government told them to do. Now the government's telling them something different. And that's deeply unfair.
Okay. So Mike.
I should also add to your point about these borrowers. I do think it's important to keep in mind that based on the data, we know that roughly, I think it's at least one in three, maybe 40% of student loan borrowers don't actually get a degree. Keep in mind, taking out student loan debt doesn't mean you finish.
Right.
And that's important too.
And when you change the terms in the middle of the game, which is kind of what's happening here, there is a risk that people will be in the middle of their college educations, realize I can't pay this back, drop out of school so they don't incur more debt. So they still have the debt that they've incurred for the first several years of that education, but now they don't have the degree. How big a problem is that, Mike? You're nodding vigorously here. How big a problem is that?
That's the face of the student loan borrower who defaults. These are people that took on debt, didn't finish their degree, didn't get the economic benefits of a degree, don't come from family money, don't have generational wealth to draw on, and just can't make ends meet. And the Trump administration has no answer for this problem other than more pain and more debt.
And Betsy, you have some figures on the student loan default rate in North Carolina right now.
Yeah, so the Department of Education about a month ago came out with a report called the non-repayment report. And just to make this clear, this is only people that left school on or after January of 2020. So these are just recent graduates. In North Carolina, there's about 132 colleges and universities. Half of those schools, one in five of their recent graduates are at least 90 days past due or approaching default. A third of them, one in four of their recent graduates are 90 days past due or more, meaning it's negatively affecting their credit. And I think that number is going to rise. And again, this is just the recent grads. These are not the, as Corey likes to call them, legacy borrowers.
President Biden didn't come up with this loan forgiveness program just out of the goodness of his heart. He did it because a lot of people were talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but they were talking about how the accumulation of an extraordinary amount of debt on the part of these college graduates, which lasted well into their middle age, prevented them from doing adult things like taking out mortgages, like buying cars, like getting married and having families, because they simply were already saddled with more debt than they could afford. So when you remove these programs that have been in place for a while and you replace them with things that are not quite as good, whether or not you think it's fair or just, does this put them back in the place that they started? Does it put the national economy, because that was one of the things we talked about when this was being suggested, that we needed to do this because it would help the national economy, does it put us back to ground zero?
No, and where we end up after all of these changes and all of this complexity and all this confusion is having an education secretary who is closing her eyes and covering her ears and pretending that everything's okay. But somebody's going to have to deal with this mess. We have an economic problem, and our economic policymakers are going to recognize that people can't buy houses. They're locked out of conventional mortgages. They can't afford cars because their car loans have doubled as a result of student debt stress. These spillover effects are real, and you can't wish them away. And the government has no plan to deal with.
Betsy.
The other thing that might surprise people is when we talk about student debt, people still, including policymakers, it's a young person's issue. Half of all student loan borrowers are over the age of 30, a quarter are over 45, and the fastest growing population that carries student loan debt are the over 65s. So these are people, it's not just affecting the mortgages and buying cars, it's affecting being able to save for retirement, and that's going to trickle down to more financial support being needed for our elderly because they can't save for retirement because of their student loan debt.
Not just save for retirement, keep food on the table and keep the lights on while you're retired. These are people that aren't working anymore and are still seeing their Social Security and their tax refunds seized to pay back old student loans.
Corey.
Mike, I just want to jump in here because I obviously when you talk about the numbers, you talk about the $1.6 trillion and the borrowers, it starts feeling really heavy and student loan debt in general starts to feel really toxic. And I just I do want to be a voice here for college and the power of college. And I'm not talking about Harvard and Princeton and Yale. I'm not talking about, you know, the elite 100 or 200 selective colleges in the country. The student loan debts that are crushing right now, and I think it was Betsy who mentioned this towards the top of the program, it's a lot of graduate school debt. The proposition of college as a tool for social mobility is still pretty darn real. As long as you don't take out too much loan debt. And the fact is, honestly, if you look at the numbers, Mike, the caps on undergraduate student loans are pretty low and reasonable. It's very difficult to graduate from college with enormous debts because the federal government doesn't let you if you're just taking out the standard undergraduate loans. And I want folks to keep in mind, if you're thinking about college and whether or not it's right for you, I think there are lots of questions and variables. And I'm not going to tell, I am not one of these people who thinks college is for everybody. College is not always the right choice. But we do need to keep in mind that college still offers a really great value proposition, especially if you're going to a good state school that offers in-state tuition, or honestly, like, let's offer a big cheer for good community colleges where you can go without maybe even taking out much debt.
So am I hearing you say that it is not the undergraduates who have taken out student loans that are causing the big problem? It is people who took out graduate level courses and the loans to support them, and at probably prestigious universities or programs that were expensive, and the salary that you can make with those degrees is not commensurate with the debt. Is that a structural problem?
One of the dirty little secrets of the student debt story. And I cannot talk about this often enough. One of the things we have seen, especially in the last 10 years, are somewhat prestigious schools, right, offering graduate degrees, often online, with their big fancy name on, especially in programs like social work. Right? Where you've got a lot of people with really good intentions who want to work in public service and do important work. And these schools are charging $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year, which is patently ridiculous. And I will say part of the problem has been that the federal student loan program up to this point has allowed those schools to charge, because the student loan program allowed essentially limitless borrowing for graduate borrowers. I don't actually blame the students. I don't blame the borrowers. They went into these things with good intentions, these programs with good intentions. These schools are essentially ripping off borrowers. And one component of the Big Beautiful Bill Act, and we can debate this too, is a new lower cap on graduate student borrowing. And I know the intention there is hopefully to rein in some of these schools that are charging way too much and offering way too little.
Yeah, under
hopefully
those, under,
it doesn't under those cost controls. It just cuts off access to credit and hopes for the best. So I guess I want to take a little issue with that and say, if you're going to be serious about shutting down programs that are ripping people off, we should be shutting down programs that are ripping people off.
Well, under this big,
but the bottom line is, it's a really good point that we talk about the student debt crisis, which is a crisis, but that's the symptom of the problem. The problem is the cost of education. Yeah. And that's what policymakers need to address, is how
part
do
of,
you...
That, Betsy, that's part of the problem. I'm going to come back to this big, beautiful bill and the caps, but I want to talk to you, Betsy, for a second about what we've just talked about. If you're applying to a school for a graduate degree that costs $100,000 to become a social worker, you should know that the job you're going to get as a social worker is not going to be commensurate with what you're paying for that degree. Are people advised, do they think about that when they take out these loans? Or do they say, well, here's the money, the government's giving it to me, let's just do it?
You know, your example is a great...
Where does the responsibility lie?
Your example is a great one, because Congress actually, back in 2007, created a program specifically to allow people that wanted to go into public service, but things like social workers, teachers, public defenders, they all require a degree, an expensive degree beyond undergraduate, to practice in those fields. But yet the pay, the ROI is not there. So they created a program called Public Service Loan Forgiveness to make sure that people could do that very thing. But for programs outside of that, you know, unfortunately, education for education's sake, those days are gone, and people do have to look at the return on investment of their degrees.
And there's some politics playing into the changing attitude about the public student loan forgiveness program, or PSLF, I think that's what it is, started in 2007 under the George W. Bush administration, altered a little bit under Joe Biden, and now Donald Trump's administration is taking a different stance on this. He called Biden's approach to this abusive, and went on to say that those policies resulted in misdirecting tax dollars to activist organizations that not only fail to serve the public, but actually harm our national security and American values, sometimes through criminal means. Mike, does any of that hold water?
No, and also it's just facially illegal. But this is the obvious endpoint of the culture war that's being driven out of the White House. This isn't student loan policy. This is about the president using student debt to be able to push organizations into towing his party line on trans rights, on immigration, on diversity, on sort of core values in our country the president takes issue with, and he's using the student loan program to get his way.
You've actually called the language that they used thinly veiled fascism. Is that a little harsh?
That is an accurate quote.
Is that a little harsh?
No, I think that's what's happening here. Again, this isn't student loan policy. This is about forcing public service employers that employ a quarter of the U.S. workforce to abandon programs the president disagrees with. And that has nothing to do with helping people pay their student loans.
So we got an email from one of our listeners, Andrew, who writes, I am thoroughly disappointed at the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. I went to Winthrop with folks who ended up in the teaching and public safety fields, and these people have worked 15 plus years and still work in their fields for qualified employers, only to discover that many have had zero luck with their loans being forgiven. Private loan consolidation along the way seems to be the culprit. These folks did not realize that they were nuking their chances consolidating to save money on monthly payments. Expand on that, because I have no idea what they're really talking about.
Well, I think the expression on Betsy's face says it all.
Betsy?
Yeah. So unfortunately, you know, people, when they look at their debt, they first thing they look at is their interest rate. And if they see the opportunity to refinance at a lower interest rate, they're like, oh, why wouldn't I do that? Except what they did is they took their federal loans that were potentially eligible for PSLF out of the federal program by refinancing them into a private program. And they lost that opportunity, as well as the other safety nets that are unique to the federal loan program. And I cringe whenever someone tells me that they did that and were potentially eligible for something like PSLF.
And why didn't they know that?
Well, it's not intuitive. Again, mostly with debt, when you have debt, the main thing you're looking at is the interest rate, and just the communications and outreach about the availability of these options and the implications of refinancing to private are not anywhere near as prevalent as they should be.
Yeah, so, let me add to that, Mike. I mean, I've done a bunch of reporting on PSLF going back to both Democratic and Republican administrations. And the fact is, there has essentially, since the beginning of the program, been an enormous disconnect between borrowers and the folks responsible for messaging how the program works. That's not just the student loan servicers. It's also the education department, right? The messaging was terrible, and borrowers were just, they just didn't get the information they needed. And that's why folks made these choices that ended up hurting them in the long run.
I wish we had time to talk about the caps on what you can borrow, both undergraduate and graduate, under the new Big Beautiful Bill provisions, because some say that the caps will put out of reach professional degrees for a lot of low-income people. They simply will not be able to pursue those professions. But we don't have time. I want to thank Corey Turner for being with us, education correspondent for NPR, Mike Pierce, executive director, co-founder of the Student Borrower Protection Center, and Betsy Mayotte, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.